Okay, the second thing to mention is that on to our passage for this morning. If you've got a Bible there, turn with me to Luke chapter 23. Luke chapter 23. And we're going to read a few verses from verse 39. Luke 23 and verse 39. If you don't have a Bible, there are some just underneath the notice board at the back. Luke 23, starting in verse 39. One of the criminals who hung there hurled insults at him. That's Jesus. "Aren't you the Messiah? Save yourself and us." But the other criminal rebuked him. "Don't you fear God?" he said. "Since you are under the same sentence, we are punished justly, for we are getting what our deeds deserve. But this man has done nothing wrong." Then he said, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." Jesus answered him, "Truly, I tell you, today you will be with me in paradise." Over the next few weeks, as we build towards Easter, we're going to look at some stories at the cross, the experiences and interactions that people have as they witness Jesus dying on the cross. Each of these stories is like a piece of a jigsaw. It's like a piece of a jigsaw. They fit together to tell us the big picture of what happened on that first Good Friday. Recently, while we were on holiday down in Nottingham, Claire, my wife, decided that she wanted to do a jigsaw puzzle. And although I'm not entirely convinced she wanted it, she received some help from me. Now, it had been years since I'd done a jigsaw, and I'd forgot how sometimes one piece can just make a massive difference in a particular area. That one piece can completely change the view, and you can see where other pieces then fit in that section. This morning, we're going to look at, as we've read, this interaction that Jesus has with the two criminals either side of him on the cross. And this is a piece of the jigsaw that illuminates the big picture in a most vivid way. So I want us to do three things this morning. First, think about the piece, this story at the cross, and think about how it fits into the bigger picture, what it illuminates about what's happening on the cross. Before then, we connect it to our story and see how it applies not just to our spiritual lives, but to our day-to-day as the scattered church, as we live our lives outside of this building, outside of this meeting. So the peace, firstly. So Calvary, where the events of Good Friday are happening, is so connected in our minds with Jesus, isn't it, that it's easy to forget that the soldiers and the authorities that were waking up that Good Friday were going about their normal business. They were off to do justice, to crucify three criminals, just as they had done regularly in that place. It's where they did it. When I was 10, the James Bond film Tomorrow Never Dies was released. And I remember around that time that every Sunday afternoon there was one of the previous Bond films on TV. And I can remember being very clearly captivated by the iconic scene in Goldfinger. Do you remember this scene in Goldfinger where Bond is shackled to a table? And there's a laser beam about to cut him in half. And it's slowly approaching. And he says to Goldfinger, the chap who is in the picture there beside Sean Connery, he says, "Do you expect me to talk?" And Goldfinger says, "No, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die." Now, I remember knowing he'd escape, but having no idea how he would do it. I actually can't even remember now how he did, but this of course, is a common trait, isn't it, in these sorts of films. The hero is in a seemingly hopeless situation, and somehow he manages to get himself out of it. But I can think of few more hopeless situations to find yourself in than hung on a cross outside the gates of Jerusalem. No amount of quick thinking or strength or clever tricks are going to get you out of this one. The Romans were very good at execution. These men were going to die. So picture the scene then for these two criminals. As three men slowly die on crosses, one man is singled out for special treatment. He has a sign above his head which reads, King of the Jews. And the crowd are shouting insults at him, telling him to save himself. Now that's unusual. If you're one of those criminals, what do you do? Well, the first criminal joins in. Verse 39. Aren't you the Messiah? Save yourself and us. Now, I'm 99% sure there's no genuine hope here to be saved for this guy. He's mocking Jesus, saying, look at you now, Messiah boy. Come on then, show us what you can do. But if there is the tiniest sliver of hope here for this criminal, there's no repentance, there's no realization that he deserves the punishment that he's receiving, there's no claim of innocence, there's just bitterness. I've often found this interesting that one of the criminals joins in. Why does he do that? He wouldn't be the first, would he? And he certainly wouldn't be the last person who, when faced with crisis and pain, lashes out in bitterness. It's quite a natural reaction, really, to suffering, isn't it? But it's selfish. It says, I'm in pain. I want you to be in pain too. The other criminal's response, though, is quite different, isn't it? He does three things. Firstly, he rebukes. This man, in response to his imminent demise, looks to the bigger picture. What happens when we die? And so he rebukes the other man with what's on his mind. Don't you fear God, since you are under the same sentence? In other words, what are you doing? Don't you know who you're going to meet when you die? Don't you know that what awaits you, a sinner, is far worse? So concern yourself with your own soul. And secondly, he realizes, this rebuke comes because he realizes something about himself and something about Jesus. He realizes that what's being done to him is, and his fellow criminal, is justice. What's happening to the man in the middle is not. On the contrary, in fact, he says this man has done nothing wrong. And thirdly, he requests. His realization goes beyond seeing Jesus' innocence. He says, Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. This man realizes that the sign above Jesus' head, behold, the King of the Jews, is, despite the intention of those who wrote it, true. Jesus is who it says he is. Jesus is the Messiah. Therefore, this man makes his request, remember me. But it's not remember me when you save yourself now. There's no request to be released from the consequences of his criminal activity. He is a bigger picture. There's a coming kingdom, an everlasting kingdom, and that's the thing that I want to be a part of. Cicero, who is one of the great Roman speakers, while criticizing a former governor who had crucified a Roman citizen, is so horrified by this. He says, crucifixion is such a cruel and disgusting punishment that it should be far removed not only from the Roman citizen's body, but from his mind, his eyes, and his ears. Crucifixion horrified Cicero. In his opinion, it ought to be reserved for the lowest of the low. Such was its brutality. Of course, the truly shocking thing is that this was not the worst thing that was happening to Jesus while he's on the cross. Do you remember back to the Garden of Gethsemane? And this is what Matthew tells us Jesus says about how he was feeling. He says, my soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death. My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death. Here is a man who contemplates the weight of what he's about to do, and it overwhelms him. It makes him sweat drops of blood, drops like blood. For on the cross, Jesus bears the weight of the sin of the whole of human history. As Paul puts it, the sinless becomes sin for us, and God's wrath is poured out on him. And all of this is happening as he hangs there, and yet here is Jesus' response to a man who, remember, is a criminal who deserves to be where he is. He says, verse 43, "Truly I tell you, today you will be with me in paradise." Now, something we're going to see over the coming weeks is that despite the immense, profound suffering that Jesus is experiencing, Jesus is not turned in on himself on the cross. He remains focused on other people, and that is incredible. Here we see it in quite remarkable grace. Jesus extends a welcome to a man with an imminent promise of what he asks for. Much more imminent, in fact, than the criminal realizes. The point of today is that redemption for him is not something which will happen at an appointed time in the future. Redemption is now, it's today. And the promise is when he finally does die on that cross, he will be with Christ. And it will be paradise. So that's the piece, but how does it fit the jigsaw? In the book of Romans, which we've spent some time in over the last few years, chapter 5 and verse 8 says this, "But God demonstrates his own love for us in this, that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us." I'm not sure there is a more vivid picture of what Paul says than what Luke records here. One of the songs that I've most enjoyed listening to over the last couple of years starts like this. It says, "I approach the throne of glory, nothing in my hands I bring, but the promise of acceptance from a good and gracious King." How could a guilty man nailed to a cross bring anything to Jesus, contribute anything to being welcomed by him? He simply asks for remembrance and he is accepted. It's beautiful. But here's the kicker. Here's where it collides with the big story for all of us. Each one of us here are just like that criminal. The Bible says before we accept Jesus as Lord of our lives, we are dead in our transgressions, spiritually dead, awaiting a death sentence of life in eternity without God. This man hanging on a cross is a very visual illustration of our position outside of Christ. But here the picture gets beautiful because we look to the center, and there is Jesus. All we need to do is come with nothing. Nothing to give, and ask for his mercy and forgiveness. Ask to be remembered, and we are accepted. More than that, we are adopted as his children. We are made righteous and promised a glorious future in paradise because our God is so good and so gracious. This morning, if you do not know that grace in your life, come and receive it. Come and accept it this morning. And if you do, if you have known that grace, you have much to rejoice in. But more than that, this grace is fuel for you as you live your lives out there. It's this that makes us give ourselves away. It's this that says, "Spirit, lead me. Spirit, guide me." Because as we look to the gospel, as we reacquaint ourselves with the good news of what Jesus has done for us, there is no better place, we realize, to leave our lives than in the hands of God. We need that reminder, well, at least I do, almost constantly. So now I want to turn our attention finally to how this story connects to our day-to-day lives as the scattered church. I don't know if this strikes you, but one of the things that strikes me about the criminal who joins Jesus in paradise is that his acceptance from Jesus does not remove him from the cross. His sins are forgiven. They're removed from him as far as the east is from the west, and yet he remains on the cross. He still pays for the crimes that he has committed. And what this clearly illustrates to us is that although sin can be forgiven in its entirety by God, there remains earthly consequences for the things that we do. And invariably, this is because our sin affects not only our relationship with God, it affects our relationship with each other. And our front lines, where we spend most of our time, these areas of our lives, these relationships that we have there, they're not immune from this. So how we react when we are sinned against, and also when we are guilty of sinning against others, is crucial for our mission as those who are witnessing for Christ. And I think Paul helps us. A passage we looked a couple of weeks ago at in Romans chapter 12, one of the verses says this: if possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. Now, as I was thinking about this through the week, I was reminded of a clip that had quite a profound impact on me about 5 years ago. It popped into my head. It's the story of Hector Black, who is a farmer just outside of Nashville. He's a white American man who all but adopted a young black girl from a difficult background into his family. Although not legally, she was treated as one of their children. And she grew up, she did well for herself. But one day, a crack addict named Ivan Simpson was caught breaking into her apartment by his daughter. And he killed her, and he violated her. He was caught, and he was sentenced. And in the courtroom, Hector was given the opportunity to speak to Ivan. Now, this is it's about a 7-minute clip, but I think it does a better job than me explaining it, so we're just going to watch it now. This is picking up the story. He's in the courtroom, and he's given an opportunity to speak to Ivan.
A statement, because I didn't know how steady my voice would be. And again, I just said how much we loved her, that she was not our daughter by any claim of birth, but she was our daughter by every claim of love. And at the end, I said, I don't hate you, Ivan Simpson, that I hate with all my soul what you did to my daughter. And then the very last thing I had to say, it was as though I was turned around and he was behind me. And I turned around and faced him when I said my last, that I wish for all of us who had been so wounded by this time, I wish that we might find God's peace, and I wish this for you also, Ivan Simpson. And our eyes met for the first time. The tears were streaming down his cheeks. I'll never forget the look. It's like a soul in hell. When they're leading away, knowing he'd spend the rest of his life, he'd die in jail. And he asked to come to the microphone, and twice, with the tears streaming down his cheeks, he said, I'm so sorry for the pain I have caused. I'm so sorry for the pain I have caused. That night I couldn't sleep. I kept thinking about this, and I thought he was letting off the street, you know, nothing. And he'd given me the only thing he had. He'd asked me to forgive him in those words. And I know he could have said, "The hell with all of you, my life is over." But he didn't. And I learned that I had forgiven him. And I felt a peace that I hadn't had in a long time. And I felt a great burden lifted on me. I started writing to him. He wrote back. And one of the things he said was that he missed God's touch. Ever since he had killed Patricia, he felt as though God had abandoned him. But he said he felt he heard God's voice by way of compassion in what I said in the courtroom. We sent him a Christmas package and I said, "Oh God, what are you doing? What are you doing? You're sending a Christmas present to the man who murdered your daughter." And I knew I had to do it. Because I think when you forgive someone, you start to care about them again. And I knew he had no one. No one in the world. We had a small group of people in Cookville. We thought we'd maybe get together with other people who had lost loved ones to violence like this. And I remember one woman whose brother had been killed 15 years before coming in and telling her story. Her brother was a doctor. He was killed by a man off the streets. To her, a nobody. And she was as angry as if it had happened the day before. And I knew I didn't want. That was no way to live. That was not life. A friend of mine told me that when you hate, you take poison and you expect the other person to die. And I think that's true. My wife and I went to South Georgia to visit Ivan in prison. It took a long time to arrange it. But we felt it was again something we needed to do. So I think what happened there was we were sitting down and talking together for 2.5 hours. It was just extraordinary. And because I'm very deaf, I was sitting very close to him. He was unshackled for it. And when it got time for us to leave, he stood up and I did too, and it seemed the most natural thing in the world that we had our arms around one another. And it was an unbelievable moment that I could have my arms around the man who murdered. And I think forgiveness is possible for the worst. And if you believe, we all need forgiveness, God knows.
Now it's my hope and prayer that none of us ever have to deal with anything as abhorrent as what happened to Hector's daughter. But what this very powerfully illustrates to us is the power that forgiveness and making peace can have, not just in the person who does the forgiving, but in the lives of other people. I don't know this man, Hector. But as I said earlier, when I watched this video and heard about his forgiveness, it had a profound impact on me. Making a move towards peace impacts others. Now, on our front lines, it's of course much more likely that our grievances with people or that they have with us are much smaller. If you're anything like me, actually, often, in fact, they can be seemingly innocuous things that are blown out of proportion. But what does it look like for us to make peace in those scenarios? And I think four things. Firstly, it's not wrong to look for justice. That's especially true if laws have been broken or if the grievances are bigger. It's not wrong to look for justice. Second, when we have been wronged, whether or not we do look for that justice, we should always look to forgive the wrong done to us. Thirdly, when someone has taken offense at something we have said or done, whether or not we think their offense is valid, we should be quick to ask for forgiveness. And fourthly, where we can, we should always seek to diffuse situations, particularly where there is a negative atmosphere. And that negative atmosphere might not have anything to do with us. We can make little impacts to culture in a place, can't we? Do you remember the story, if you were at the weekend away, Andrew told us a story about a cleaner who put biscuits on desks, and she did it anonymously, and it got everyone talking because they wanted to know where they came from. And then this chatting became a part of the culture in that area. It was a very simple thing that she did. Well, we can do simple things where there's those negative atmospheres. Something as simple as a smile can make a huge amount of difference. The last thing to say, though, is tragic, because while forgiveness is always possible, living at peace may not be. That's why Paul says, as far as it depends on you, because peace, for peace to be made, for reconciliation to happen, there needs to be movement from both sides. We saw that in Hector's story there, didn't we? Now, Hector had a heck of a long way further to move. But Ivan did have genuine sorrow for what he had done, and he did ask for forgiveness. So as we close, just some questions for us to think about as we go into our scattered weeks on our front lines. Firstly, is there a situation or an atmosphere that I can make a difference to this week by helping to diffuse it? Second, am I holding on to things, perhaps even little things that are impacting negatively my mission as Christ's witness? And thirdly, are there people who rightly or wrongly have some grievance against me that I need to make the first move towards in order to make peace? So those are some questions for us to take into our weeks. I think we're going to sing one.